Hello, and welcome to another episode of Art and Labor, the podcast dedicated to the ongoing struggle to survive as an art and or cultural worker. I am Lucia Love, flying solo, conducting an interview today, because OK is in the midst of moving a house that they were in for about 7 years. So it's pretty intense. You know, all the punks, they gotta go. But I am joined here today by a really fabulous painter, Christine. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Christine Wang. I make paintings. I teach at California College of Art right now in the painting department in first year and grad fine arts.
Yeah. Whoa. So then that means you must have some experience with this remote teaching that everyone is saying is kind of a nightmare.
Yeah, I had to move my classes in the middle of the semester to online classes. So I had to do graduate meetings on Zoom, and my painting one class, my painting two class, and my foundation drawing class all finished up on Zoom.
Basically. God.
Yeah.
How is that? Do people just sign into the Zoom and then they're all, are they all like completing work while they're online, or are you lecturing to them, or like, how does that work?
I mean, we had to do a combination of what they call synchronous and asynchronous teaching. So the synchronous teaching would be everyone at the same time on Zoom, whereas asynchronous teaching would be maybe people read something that I posted on Google Classroom, or they give each other feedback, or they're making art at different times offline and then like coming together on a learning platform like Google Classroom. So they really encouraged me to, they being CCA's administration, they encouraged me to like do a mix of the two. And I definitely didn't want to be on Zoom for like 6 hours. So I tried to keep my Zoom meetings short and just have students make art and then post it.
Right. That's wild. It's like, we never knew that Instagram culture could be this relevant. It's like, I feel like that's all any painters do anyway. It's just make something and then post it for the community, you know?
Yeah. It was really, really hard. And I think another reason why we needed to like do asynchronous teaching was a lot of my students are Chinese nationals, and they would go back to China, have like a flight that lasted like maybe 4 days with different transfers and testing at each, you know, transfer, and then back in China they would be in a quarantine hotel for two weeks.
Right. I saw a video of that where you get a tracker, like a wristband tracker, and then you get like food sent to your room so that you just don't leave for anything.
Yeah, my kids were not allowed to leave. They, you know, they tried to use, you know, get a VPN to be able to log into Google Classroom. When I had class at noon, it was like 3 a.m.
or oh, something. God.
For the, you know, so like we, you know, sitting in a Zoom meeting with everybody was just really, really hard for some students.
And yeah.
It was kind of stressful. But back to like what you were saying about Instagram or posting, I really had to like push the kids to like crop their images and take better photos and like
it's kind of like an unintentional lesson, like yeah. We're all gonna learn how to document now.
Yeah, because they would post things and I was like, I can't give you feedback on this because I can't see it. It's really hard for me to see.
Oh, so that's kind of darling.
Yeah, I mean, like, so in my classes, I'm like, okay, if it's critique day, you know, hang it on the wall and, you know, make sure it's level and learn how to use a hammer and nail and just put some nails in the wall, you know. And, you know, this has to be done before critique, you know.
Oh, and, yeah, they sign on and they're like, can you just help me?
Yeah. And then like the online version is like, okay guys, just go into Photoshop and learn how to use perspective crop, you know, just like auto color correct. Key. Yeah.
Oh man. I mean, there's a little something to be said for that though, because it was definitely those skills were missing from my art education, where, you know, it was just sort of like none of the business was really illuminated for us. None of the like, oh, well, you have to make a lot of PDFs. From here on out, kids, you're going to have to learn how to make very nice looking PDFs of everything that you do. And that little thumbnail, it better be just ballin'.
Where did you go to school?
I went to School of Visual Arts.
Oh, did you like it? How was it?
It was all right. There was a lot of focus there on art that was, it was like in the 70s, you know, it was very much like, all right, you come here, you're going to learn about the fine art scene in the 70s. You're going to learn about like 112 Green Street and, you're going to know about like Joseph Kosuth and yeah, it's very New York. I started in the animation department, so yeah, I got a lot of like technical skills from there before transferring to fine art, which was a blessing.
Yeah, so important.
But I saw that you studied with Andrea Fraser.
Oh yeah, shout out to Andrea.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Boss lady.
Yeah. How was that? I mean, it was she very much into like disseminating institutional critique?
Well, it was amazing. She's still at UCLA teaching, so if anyone wants to go to grad school for interdisciplinary art, you know, just try to work with her because she's very, very, very smart. And of course, you know, like this huge figure in institutional critique. But when she was teaching at UCLA, when I was there from 2010 to 2013, she was more and more interested in group psychodynamics. So she was really interested in how a group could reflect the, could have a psychology the way one single person could have a psychology, kind of like, so she was really into this Tavistock method where everybody, it was like developed by a psychoanalyst, I think his last name was Bion, but he would get groups of people together, and maybe like one person would act out and act like the super ego, or another person would like be the like id, maybe, or like you know, like this idea that a whole group could behave like maybe like one mentally ill person.
Wow. Yeah, that that's interesting, because it kind of reminds me of some like cybernetic experiments and like different ways to play around with networking. Mm-hmm. And I can't think of who did the experiment now, but it's one of my favorites, like where a theater full of people were handed ping pong paddles, and then there was like a screen above them where the whole crowd had to play ping pong with each other by flashing, like one side of the ping pong paddle was red and one side was green. So it's like, if it's green, then that means you want your side of the pong game, like the little paddle, to go up or down if it's red. So everyone is sort of like trying to gauge what everyone else is doing to move the to move their representative on screen paddle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's interesting. There is something to be said for everybody connecting, but I don't know. Then there's that added level if you separate people's activity into a kind of a specialized way of being, like, oh, I'm only the id. It's such a weird way to go about it.
Well, the idea is like, maybe I'm not really that familiar with it, but the idea is like the group would have a task, right? So some people have like, so the group wants to survive, and then there's some times the group will like choose someone to be dependent on, like they'll try to be dependent on a charismatic leader. Huh. Or if the group is functioning in a fight or flight mode, they'll perceive an enemy and depend on fighting and being very aggressive towards the perceived enemy. Yeah,
and these are all just like, these are all just settings that people are given.
Well, what she's really into is there's these group relations conferences where you could actually go, and it's usually like nurses or psychologists or like mental health professionals who sign up for this conference. They all go into a room for like they keep going back every weekend, every day of the weekend. So like Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And in the group, the group's task is to reflect on itself. So instead of like going to therapy with your therapist where you like reflect on yourself, all these people get together in a group and reflect on the group.
Whoa, that sounds kind of like a Maoist. It's like self-critique. It's like, how can you all be better comrades?
Oh my gosh. I'm listening right now to China in 10 Words. And it's by, let me see. It's by Hua Yu. And he talks about growing up during the Cultural Revolution.
Oh gosh.
It sounds so bananas. It's so...
Yeah. I mean, I could only hope to be young enough to be like given a rifle and forced to like attack my teachers or something, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, Definitely don't want to be anyone's parents in that situation, or like a landlord, or
oh my God.
Yeah, could you imagine?
Yeah, it's so bananas. I love reading like horror stories. But yeah, I think the group relations is very interesting because like so I think Andrea like tried to get away from art jargon and like went and looked more and more towards psychoanalysis for ways to talk about feelings and groups and like how groups behave. And now definitely like the idea of a group of people, like even like a nation wanting to have a perceived enemy that's maybe not the most mature response to anxiety about not being able to survive.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's kind of like sort of an old standby for like colonialist ethics. It's like, well, you know, if you make your own nationalist front and then you make an enemy, you can really galvanize your own people into doing all kinds of things in the name of war. So let's build that strong group identity from the ground up, everybody.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But that's interesting, though. So you studied with Andrea Fraser and kind of had this immersive group experience.
Yeah, we all had to, everyone who took her critique class all had to go to the conference.
That's wild.
Together as a class. And now she's trained, she's gone through training, and she can actually kind of host, not really host the conference, but like be one of the leaders in the conference and guide people through the group and say, hey, let's reflect on what's happening in the group.
So then how do you feel like this sort of in-depth understanding of group mechanics ended up bringing you to a painting practice? Because I feel like there's such a wide, like, distance there.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've always been a painter. I got into UCLA through the painting department. And it's a interdisciplinary program, so even though I made paintings, I could still, you know, take courses with Andrea and get individual meetings with her, which is really amazing, and I was super lucky. But it helped me like think about my paintings in terms of relationship, like how the paintings might relate to the viewer or to me, or maybe how they are, maybe how there's like the explicit and then the implicit content or the latent content, and or just maybe like how the paintings function as jokes and how the jokes could be psychological or somehow like dispelling tension.
Yeah, it makes sense. Just to, I guess, like I'm thinking of the ways that critiques are done in general, and a lot of the time it is a group activity. It is something that we sort of, I don't know, like when I was in art school, yeah, we would gather around and we would all attempt to be our most generous selves in discussing each other's creativity and what we were seeing and how it might be possible to like to clarify an expression or to heighten certain things that we were seeing or to like question certain things that we didn't understand. And I think that's something that people kind of leave out in the discussion of painting, because it can end up becoming like a material discourse, or it ends up becoming a market discourse. And it's like not often talked about as something that actually operates to like stir conversation in people.
Yeah. Well, it depends on the painting, right?
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah, I mean, definitely the group relations conference felt like a critique without any art. So we were just, like all the misery, none of the fun.
Oh God. Yeah, I'm just like, why don't you just do life better?
Or it's like, it was more like that thing that you said, I found it was very aggressive, and it seems like the group right now is ganging up on me and they're all siding with you, and you know, it would just be like that, like for a whole weekend, you know.
Oh, that's so emotional.
It was so emotional.
Yeah. And at the end, everybody just gets their own one-bedroom apartment.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is LA, so there's a backyard, hopefully.
Oh, right.
Well, you know, I think paintings, you know, like, I don't know. Paintings, I think, okay, I think you get the art you deserve.
you suckers, you asked for Jeff Koons. That's why there's balloon dogs everywhere.
It's what they deserve.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I mean the customer is always right.
Yeah. So painting wise, it's like I think whenever I make a painting, it's like, for me, it's like I'll get the level of discourse that I deserve.
Oh, that's great. Well, maybe now is a good time to sort of attempt in whatever way we can to put words to the kind of images that you make, because you kind of I mean, I think they're great. Like you
oh,
take those.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's like these kind of classic meme forms.
Yeah.
But there's like these very specific curations around the images that you choose and put together. And then there is sort of, I don't know. I would say it's like the color palette that you use is different than the original memes. So it kind of has a, I don't know, it's like lighter almost. So I see it as if it's sort of like a memory, or like it's almost sort of like the lighter palette makes it almost, reminds me of springtime or something. It's like, I'm thinking of, you have this one meme that is of Kellyanne Conway into like into the crypt keeper, like skeleton dude. And it's just like 2016, kind of normal, 2017, getting bad, 2018, just going out there.
Yeah.
But then the way that you painted the figures, it's sort of like kind of breezy almost.
Like kind of pretty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm never sure if that's like a bad word to use in art. Cause you know how sometimes like if you say a thing is beautiful or pretty, it's like those terms go in and out of fashion.
Well, I really like, I'm so glad you mentioned that painting. I love that painting because it's like when I showed it was like a year and a half late. you know? Yeah. And like, I just like the idea of a painting that's like, I don't know, like kind of missed the trend, you know?
Yes.
Like kind of like, just like a little bit late to the party because it just can't keep up with like Reddit or whatever.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's kind of one of the nice things about working in a medium that everyone says is dead.
Oh,
is
yeah.
Like, it's like, oh, now I get to make timeless statements.
Or it just makes the, I kind of like, okay, so like that painting is from a show that I made of cryptocurrency memes.
Yes, I love this show. Yeah. Crypto memes, women, and Leo DiCaprio.
Right, yes. That was the title of the show. And I liked the idea of like a show that didn't try to be pretty. It didn't try to be universal. It didn't try to be timely. It was just like, I tried to like make everything wrong, you know? Like it's like photorealism is like not a fashionable painting style.
Yes. Yeah. And like, why would you just represent things as they are in this market? There's nothing about abstract figuration in here. I'm confused.
There's no like, the paint was like super thin and watery. There's nothing, it's acrylic. There's nothing like juicy and oily about it. You know, there's nowhere to like fetishize, you know?
Right. Yeah, that's amazing. It's just like a straightforward recreation of a thing that was on the internet.
Yeah, and there, for me, there was like a pathetic kind of failure, you know? Like I could never be as good as a printer. No matter how hard I try, you know?
Yeah, there's always going to be like the human hand is incapable of completely like recreating every pixel. But then it's different than the like Corey Archangel sort of like dealing with technological failure.
No, I'm interested in human failure.
Yeah.
You know?
Which is great because, so this show kind of centers around the creation of cryptocurrency and then also this failure of communicating how to like hold on to your bitcoins.
Totally.
Yeah. So it's like all of these paintings just have HODL on them and like, yeah. I don't know. I love the Leo painting that just says stay calm and hodl.
Yeah. Leo's a big one. He's very popular on the internet, I feel like.
Yeah. He's so memeable.
Yeah.
And then he keeps showing up. He keeps inserting himself into world issues.
Yeah. So after this, that show, I made a whole nother show of just Leonardo DiCaprio climate change memes.
Oh, amazing. Because of the accusations that he's been bankrolling the Amazon rainforest fires.
It was like, I made this body of work late last year. So like November, December 2019, and it was all just Leonardo DiCaprio like holding Kate Winslet's hand, you know, like for in the Titanic when they're both like frozen, kind of like freezing, and and instead of saying like promise me you'll live, you know, just promise me, instead of saying that, instead of saying like promise me Rose, he's like saying like climate change is real. Like, I don't
know. Oh, I think the recording cut out there for a sec.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, he just says, like, climate change is real. Never let go.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, in his one final moment, he can
and
really...
And then there's, like,
really
another painting that says,
people.
Like... Wait, go ahead.
Sorry. Oh, he can really impart a message in his final moments.
Yeah. And then there's, like, another painting where he's crying. There's all of these faces of his, like, that are crying. And it says, climate change is real. Stop procrastinating now.
And... Oh, I'm just wondering, like, so, because he's kind of still on the... scene, right? Like, he still goes to art fairs and stuff.
And oh, yeah.
Has he ever seen any of these paintings?
I think so. My German gallery claims that he saw them. He saw one or two in Miami during Art Basel. And, like, some of them are, like, funny and nice, and then some of them are, like, pretty mean. You know? Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, oh, sorry, DiCaprio, you're part of, like, the public domain, so it's nothing personal.
It's really nothing personal. It's not, it's not personal.
Yeah, I just love that idea, though, because if you, you know, it's like not only making really clear statements about how we're dealing with the world, but it's also like making direct statements about how we're dealing with the world to the people who are in the memes. It's just like,
yeah,
I don't know.
Well, I think that can be like where the group dynamics happens or something. It's like, it's not personal to Leonardo DiCaprio. I'm using him as a metaphor for all of our kind of like hypocrisy.
Yeah. And it's interesting just thinking about the way that your paintings could function in an art fair like Basel.
Yeah.
Where it's like, so you're putting these statements about climate change, about like income inequality, about like the kind of like convoluted ways that, you know, like cryptocurrencies are supposed to work. And then like, I can only imagine what happens to collectors when they're looking at these kind of like protest statements.
I have no idea. I really have no idea. I have no idea.
No, I wouldn't imagine anyone but them to know.
Yeah. I mean, there's some paintings that just don't sell and like seem more difficult to sell. Like, I made a painting of Harvey Weinstein, right? And it says, I wish I was a white man.
Wow!
On top of it, you know?
Wow, that's so intense.
So I don't think anyone, you know, I don't think anyone would want to, like, buy it and put it in their bedroom or something.
No, that one, you gotta save that one for the institution.
What institution? You know? Oh my god. The institution, what institution is gonna buy a painting of Harvey Weinstein that says, I wish I was a white man?
Maybe the Whitney. They're pretty into doing critiques of themselves and of the system.
I don't know. Some people, okay, some people are like, A, he's not white, he's Jewish.
Yeah, which is why crazy. It's so awkward.
Yeah, super awkward. B is like, they think I'm serious. They're like, what? Why would you want to be a white person?
Oh, yeah, they take it as a cry for help.
Yeah. They're like, actually, there was a white supremacist page, like from in like a woman on Instagram in New Zealand who like reposted one of my paintings, didn't give me credit, and was like, yeah, you know, like being white is great.
Oh no. Yeah, that's the danger with irony.
So you know, I don't think I mean, if you could hook me up with the Whitney's acquisition, you know, that'd be amazing, but I doubt it.
Yeah, I'll see what I can do, you know.
I can do a twofer, like a throw one in for free, you know. I can do a deal.
Yeah, like, hey, listen, you can take this really, really psychologically charged painting and just like keep it until after I'm dead. And then, but you can have this nicer one and just put it in some, you know, put it in some surveys. Nice American art for you.
OMG.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that is, it is wild though, because it's like, I think a lot of people make paintings and they try to think about hitting the spot of like, what is just new enough for someone to be interested in and then buy, and just like something that's like kind of challenging enough, but that it's not going to really push anybody's buttons and it's not going to direct anybody to like look at the system around the painting. So I'm always excited to see when those kind of challenges are produced of like, no, this is a statement in itself and it deserves to be made whether or not somebody wants to buy it.
Thanks, Lucia.
Yeah, anytime, Christine. I believe in you. Oh,
Jesus, I needed that.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, it can be really hard. Like, I also make work sometimes and I think like, oh no, like anytime I feel like I'm going too far, I'm like, oh, I'm probably not going far enough.
Oh yeah? What was the last time, what was the last thing you made where you felt like that?
Well, I guess the last time I felt a little uncomfortable was when I made a painting, like I have a reoccurring character that is like this woman who is in shackles and like a neck extender. So she like can't use her hands or anything. She just is like stuck in bondage. But I made this one painting where she burns to death in the middle of a burning carousel.
Nice.
And then she like turns into a genie.
Ooh.
So it's not all bad. You know, you get to become a mythical creature after you die. But yeah, when I was putting it out there, I was like, oh my God, maybe this is too much to paint a burning lady.
Sounds great.
Yeah. And but those are the kind of things that people really want to, like, I don't know, they want to connect to and not, I don't know. Like, I don't really think about collectors, I guess. I think about my friends and what they would see as awesome.
Oh yeah, I think I'm looking at it on Artsy. Is this the one that you're talking about?
Yeah,
it looks fabulous. I love it.
Thanks, dude.
The boobs are like the lit from below look really good.
Yeah, like big anime titties.
Yeah. You know, at the end of the day, it's like, it's just a picture, right? Like,
yeah.
No animals were harmed in the making of this picture.
Yeah, all my brushes are synthetic.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. Yeah, right? Just to really, really drive home the animal safety.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's hard, I think, at this time to think about ways that painting can connect to the moment that we're going through.
Yeah.
And yeah, and it's just, it's sort of like, I see a lot of ways that like it's unnecessary for painting to do that. But then if you, I don't know, for me, I have this sort of like, I need to connect to the world with a narrative. I need to sort of look at power systems, and I need to admit that there's a world full of people, that like aesthetics don't just exist in a vacuum.
Yeah.
And, yeah. I don't know, how do you feel like about, I guess, talking about activism that you do? Because
I quit. I used to volunteer for Critical Resistance, which is a national prison industrial complex abolitionist group, and I volunteered for them for like, you know, 8 years, 9 years. But I stopped because my teaching load was getting too big. But I volunteered in LA. There was this huge jail fight going on, you know, $2.7 billion plan to take women and move them to a new jail, and then move people in Men's Central and tear down Men's Central and make a new Men's Central and basically expand bed capacity.
Oh God.
Yeah. So I worked on that campaign for many, many years, and I left LA and the fight was still going on. And finally the Board of Supervisors, I think that they scrapped it. They scrapped the whole plan last year. So
that's amazing. Great.
It's so amazing. Right now we're looking at a lot of, I know that my friends are working really, really hard to get imprisoned people released because the health conditions in the jails and prisons are terrible. There's no coronavirus testing. There's no personal protective equipment. And folks should be free anyway.
So, yeah, honestly.
So this is like, I think this is a good pressure point. Like right now, strategically, it could be like a very important point for the abolitionist movement. And at the same time, there's a lot of danger, right? Like folks on the inside are dying. They've always been dying, but now it's very dangerous. So there's like an opportunity, but at the same time, it's more than just an opportunity. It's like literally life or death.
Yeah, it is pretty incredible to see the way that the stakes have risen in all areas of organizing. Like we also have some prison abolition groups going here that are like they're ranging anywhere from just trying to get inmates bars of soap.
Yeah.
And it's like, and it's so insane, like how much organization has gone into friends being like, okay, so if we manage to collect all of this soap to bring them, then we can make sure that they actually get it also.
Yeah.
And then there's also people working to say, like, in other countries, prisoners were moved because of COVID. And it's not like we're asking something that is completely unfathomable or unprecedented or something. Others are doing that for people who are in their communities, because like there's so many ridiculous things that people end up in prison for anyway. All of it is unwarranted.
Yeah. Well, the abolitionists, they borrowed the word from slavery abolitionists, right? They said, just like there's no such thing as a good slave owner, we are saying there is no such thing as a good prison or a good cage. And yeah. I think that framing, that idea that you could have abolitionist reforms to imprisonment that reduce the imprisoned population, reduce the scope of the prison industrial complex, reduce the amount of money spent on policing and imprisonment, that idea of trying to shrink this monster rather than reform it, like make it better, give it body cams, give it, I don't know, diversity training or sensitivity training, you know, like the idea that the real necessary reforms will actually shrink the PIC. I think it just really made a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think after seeing those kind of like cool out places where I don't know, if you're like in a Scandinavian country and you do a crime, you go and you live in a little house, yeah, and you get like a PlayStation 2 instead of a PlayStation 4 or something. It's like, it could be so much easier to help people if they get into a situation and there's absolutely no reason to be turning everything into a profit machine.
Yeah.
Just like, yeah, I mean.
Well, we have to understand that in the United States, the prison industrial complex abolition is also like a part of Black liberation, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like last night, there was an uprising in Minneapolis, right? Mm-hmm. Because.
Yeah, it was huge, rioting.
Yeah, because people understand that the police, it's a tool of anti-Black racism.
Yeah. Yeah, the entire system that we've been living through is just, I mean, it's just a pipeline back to slavery, but with a different name. It's terrible.
Yeah. Well, now instead of African Americans, their labor being capitalized, now their bodies are seen as like producing excess labor that's no longer necessary. So they have to be. They have to like endure weathering and early death and confinement. So it's no longer like a means of production, but actually like a means of like slow death.
Yeah, it's I mean, definitely if you subscribe to Agamben's conception of biopolitical power, it's like there are just certain subjects in the neoliberal order that will be relegated to the ban of any kind of resources, like any access to resources.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you, so you were working with them for the past 8 years to, help everyone fight to, stop production of a new prison complex.
Well, it's county jail. So when I was in LA, I worked on the jail fight. And, when I was in, when I was volunteering for Critical Resistance Oakland in the Bay Area about 2 years ago, I was doing more like fundraising and communications and onboarding new volunteers. We also did volunteer night where we answered prisoner mail, which was nice. Yeah, it was really nice. And, you know, just supported the volunteers, got snacks, stuff like that.
Yeah, made community.
Yeah. But there's several campaigns in the Bay Area that I didn't work too much on. And one of them is Close 850 Bryant. So there's a jail on 850 Bryant Street, and it should really just be closed. There's not that many people in it, and it's not earthquake safe, and no one should be living there and working there.
Yeah. Get rid of it.
Exactly. Or,
yeah, level it and then turn the space into a park.
Yeah. So there's that campaign.
Cool. And I guess we're rounding up on an hour now. Mm-hmm. But yeah, is there anything else, anything that you're working on now that you would want to share coming up, or anything you want people to see?
Oh my gosh, okay. So I want to make a body of work of like coronavirus memes.
Oh my god.
So if you have any like good coronavirus memes, please send them to my email.
Oh my god. I saw this one that was like Oprah for the car giveaway.
Oh yeah. And you get
And you get coronavirus. And you get coronavirus.
Any other good memes? Lots of toilet paper memes. There's lots of like good coronavirus toilet paper memes.
Oh god, yeah. There's that, and there's lots of like wash your hands memes.
Oh god, yeah.
Yeah, it's all, I don't know, just wait for the terrible,
the plague.
It's the second wave is not gonna be coronavirus, it's gonna be the memes. It's just, but yeah, okay, I guess that kind of wraps everything all up.
Thanks for having me, Lucia.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you for coming on, Christine.
Yeah,
pleasure. It's good to get to know about where you're coming from.
Yeah, thanks for talking to me about painting. Let's have fun. Let's have fun. Let's have fun.
Let's have fun. Let's have fun. Let's have fun. Lots of fun. Let's have fun. Let's have fun. Let's have fun. Lots of fun.